Any questions? I think what we'd like to do next is TransCanada for a cross-examination of the of these folks, the agency folks.
Yes, thank you.
Now, we also, let me just quickly, the Consolidated Parties and Friends of Boundary Mountains.
The Friends did not request any.
Oh, did not request, okay. So we've, and then we've got.
Boundary Mountains would like to cross-examine for a few minutes some of the people from the state agencies. I guess because of my inexperience, I was not aware that we could just request it. I didn't realize they were going to be here. I did ask at times if they were going to be here or not. It wasn't clear to me, but I would really appreciate some time to cross-examine.
Okay. Let me just... Juliet, how much time do you need?
I'm assuming you want something less than the 30 minutes allocated.
Well, if you could do that.
Yeah, I'll try to keep it to I'll try to keep it to 20.
Okay.
Well, the question is how long can
my understanding was that the state employees had some prior engagements that some people needed to leave. Is that true? I mean, how long are you guys available? Okay. Well, we have, the time that's been allocated is 30 minutes for TransCanada, 25 for the Consolidated Parties. Friends has just requested 10 minutes. So that's about an hour or so.
Well, and you've got the public session starting at 6.
Madam Chair, if it would be helpful, we're willing to reduce our time to 12 minutes.
Let's get going.
Okay. Mr. Stearns, just a few questions, and I don't mean any disrespect by this, but you don't consider yourself a visual expert, do you? Okay, I can't hear you.
Page one in my initial comments, no, I am not a visual expert.
And you don't think this project will impact BPL's conservation or acquisition priorities or programs, right, in this area? I think that's on page 6 of your comments.
Well, frankly, I think that TransCanada has, since my comments, put some money on the table with partners that we've worked with, so I think you're bringing stuff to the table that will impact our conservation strategies, and that may be a good thing.
Okay. I probably should have said you don't think it will adversely affect conservation strategies.
I think at this point, people aren't going to rally to buy a mountaintop if it's immediately next to wind turbines. The question is, are any people currently rallying for those mountaintops in this particular region? And the answer is no. So no, there isn't a lot of conservation activity in that immediate vicinity. So no, it's hard to negatively impact it if it currently is not actively organized.
And I just, I think on page 5 of your comments, and just to be clear for the commission, BPL does not oppose the Kibbe expansion, correct?
I have been very careful not to say that I find that there is an unreasonable adverse impact. I have said that I think that's a very difficult question for the commissioner to answer. God bless them, they get paid so much.
And is it fair to say that the real thrust of your comments address your desire to shape future policy in this area?
Correct. And I think the one area that we haven't spent much time talking about tonight is tangible benefits, that since my comments, TransCanada has put some additional tangible benefits on the table, and that's something that I flagged in my comments, predicting that would happen. That seems to be what happens, is that applicants start putting tangible benefits on the table. Sure enough, that's what's happening, and at some point we should discuss some of those conservation-oriented tangible benefits and look for the Commission's response on how they view the structure of the offer.
Thank you. And in the interest of time, I'm going to move on to Mr. Palmer, some questions on your report that you've done. Just a technical matter, you assumed a turbine height of 90 meters or 295 feet. In fact, the turbine hubs are 80 meters or 262 feet, and I assume the mistake is because there was a typo in Ms. Vissering's report. But you would agree that the substantially lower turbine height than you assumed would impact your evaluation of where the turbines could be seen from, correct? And that might, in your comments on page 17, you noted that the turbines appeared a little bit shorter in Ms. Vissering's simulations than you would have expected. And again, that would be explained by your mistaken assumption that the turbine height was 90 meters, correct?
That's correct. It also explains why I'm adding more vegetation on sort of my perspectives in the back.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And on the Arnold Trail, your understanding is that was designated primarily for non-scenic reasons, right?
In my reading of the nomination form and the battlefield form, too, that's correct.
Yep. And I think that you stated in your report that to describe the Arnold Trail as being experienced as a, quote, vast, hostile wilderness, close quote, seems to be a bit of hyperbole, right?
Yes.
I think in terms of technique, you identified that viewshed maps are a tool and are best considered a preliminary analysis of potential visibility, right?
Absolutely.
And that the really most important is to have visual simulations so that you can really understand, particularly if you have criteria that are a little bit fuzzy, so the decision maker can understand what the visual impact of the project is, right?
That's right. And so we should be making simulations that at least cover the worst case situations, and I think that that's been done here.
Right. So you agree that Ms. Vissering has really provided the worst case visual simulations for the Commission to review, right?
That's right. And then there'll be places where you can't see them at all.
And with respect to those simulations, you agree that they were done appropriately and in accordance with the best professional practices, right?
Yes, and I observed Dana taking pictures and following the field procedures that are at least as good as anything I do.
And just so we're clear, because there's been discussion about the number of resources, you agree that the following scenic resources will have no views of the project: Round Pond, Lower Pond, Spencer Stream, Natanas Pond Overlook, and the Serampus Falls Rest Area, right?
Yeah, Serampus Falls will apparently have views of the existing Kibbe, but not the expansion.
Okay. And then on your discussion of cumulative impacts, you identified the greatest potential for serious cumulative impacts on Kibbe Stream, right?
Yeah, and you should underline the potential.
And
I agree with that.
And I assume you heard Ms. Vissering's presentation and the discussion of the fact that there is, and you acknowledge that there could be a vegetated buffer along Kibbe Stream that would potentially eliminate the cumulative impact concern.
Yes, but whenever she talks about that, it's clear that there's some places where that doesn't exist, and I don't know where that is. So I'd have to go look. But it's not going to be extensive.
Okay.
So
you'd agree that cumulative impacts from Kibbe Stream is not a significant concern?
Only because I don't think that there's going to be very much visibility from Kibbe Stream, and I don't know where the visibility will actually occur, because you have to get out there and look.
which Ms. Vissering's done. And
I don't actually, has she really walked that whole stretch?
Well, I think she's looked at aerial photographs, which give an indication of where there's vegetation.
Right, and so there's, and when she presents this information, she says that there's some places where you may be able to see it. They're just not very big, and I don't get the sense that she's been there. I know I have not been there, so.
Well, you went to the one area she identified, which was the cleared opening that has a gravel pit and parking log area, right? That's
correct, yes.
And doesn't raise cumulative impact concerns to you, does it?
No, and I would agree that, you know, as far as the stream goes, that's one of the least scenic potential areas, right?
And then also on cumulative impacts, you in your comments, you referenced some work that you've done and the suggestion that the first impact is the most significant and subsequent additions contribute to overall scenic impact, but never as much as the first impact, right?
Within a particular view, yes, that's accurate.
Okay, yeah. And yeah. That the implication for wind power was that concentrating wind energy development may have a lower overall impact on the state than distributing it throughout the state, right?
Yes, I'm very confident that that's accurate.
And that once an area is deemed appropriate for wind development, and this is quoting from your report at page 20, then it makes the most sense to fully develop its potential rather than to move on to another area, right?
That would be my judgment, that it makes more sense to fully develop one area once we've really looked at what the impact to that area is going to be, rather than develop half of it and then half develop another area somewhere else in the state. The difficulty, though, is we never did the build-out analysis here. What we're doing is making this decision one piece at a time, and we know there's more potential here, or we know you think there's more potential here because you're asking to expand the expedited zone.
Yep, thank you. I appreciate that. Mr. Clement, just a couple of questions for you. You referenced another wind power project that had a finding of adversity. They worked out mitigation, and your understanding is that project was permitted both by the state and the Army Corps, right?
I did not say that. I said that an adverse impact had been identified, and I wasn't clear, but the Corps and MHPC and the applicant are working on mitigation. We do have another example out there that is more in line with what you just suggested, and that's the Record Hill project, where a potential adverse impact or an adverse impact was noted to two properties that were potentially eligible for listing or eligible for listing on the historic register. There, again, we put together mitigation, put together a memorandum of agreement to commemorate that mitigation, and ultimately the permit was issued with a condition that they implement the various provisions of the MOA, but the Oakfield permit has not been issued yet.
The state permit has, though, right?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
So just so the commission appreciates that the finding of adversity under the federal review program, which is what we're talking about, is not a determination a project should not proceed, but as I think as you characterize it, is to go to the next step to work out appropriate mitigation.
Correct.
And which happens in many projects in the state of Maine.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Cordes, a few questions, I think either for you or Mr. Timpano, I'm not sure which. And follow up on Commissioner Kurtz's question about shouldn't we be concerned about non-jurisdictional vernal pools? In fact, the applicant here is meeting the standards for these non-jurisdictional vernal pools as if they were jurisdictional significant vernal pools, correct?
Yeah, correct.
Okay. And we heard testimony earlier today about Bicknell's thrush, and I just want to get your feedback on, there was a question about the scope of the pre-construction surveys that have been done, and my understanding is that IFNW feels that they were appropriate in scope and methodology, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. And that species was, in 2007, the state went through a process of reviewing whether to add the Bicknell thrush to as a listed species, right? In 2007, didn't IFNW evaluate whether to add the Bicknells to the list of the state-listed threatened or endangered species?
Yeah, in 2007, there was an update to the endangered species list.
Okay, and the state didn't add the Bicknells at that time, right?
No.
Okay. Just give me 1 minute, I can be focused. Also, on the Bicknells, I think that you've seen what the determinations are with respect to impact to the habitat that would result from the project. And is it your opinion that the impact will put the species at risk in the state of Maine, the impact of the habitat on the proposed as part of this project?
I would say that, you know, our initial concerns were that turbine 11. And now that that turbine 11 has been moved outside of that, the core area or on the fringe of that, that occupied habitat, that we don't find any unreasonable impact.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So the consolidated parties, I believe, are next.
Since we left off with Mr. Cortez and Mr. Timpano, I'll just follow along that line. In IFNW's comments submitted on March 3rd, you indicated that your greatest concern was for turbine 11, but you also identified four additional turbines that you had some concerns about. Could you, you didn't describe what those concerns were. I wonder if you could do that at this time.
Well, I think those other all those turbines were located within Bicknell's thrush habitat, so there'd be direct habitat loss impacts from that. But that turbine 11 was our greatest concern because it would bisect that occupied habitat.
So, in addition to the direct habitat loss caused by the project, which, will there be edge effects or habitat degradation along the edge of the road turbines, the turbine roads and the pads?
Is your question, will there be effects?
Yes, will there be edge effects? Sure. That will degrade the habitat in addition to the direct impacts?
At some level, sure.
Okay.
All right, Dave Publicover with the Appalachian Mountain Club. I have a few questions for Ms. Dougherty. You stated, in results to previous questioning, that this project would have an adverse impact on the community, but you left it to the commission to determine whether it rose to the level of adverse.
Unreasonable.
Unreasonable, and maybe that's the term. Undue or unreasonable. But it would be fair to say that this, the level of impact created by this project would certainly not be considered minimal.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I've shown you, Dylan, Dylan's going to give you a map. This is the map that was attached to the pre-filed testimony of Don Hudson. We've seen this several times. In both the comments submitted by the Natural Areas Program and on this map, there was an assumption of essentially an edge effect area, and you used 50 feet to determine the indirect impact area. The Natural Areas Program is a partner in the Beginning with Habitat partnership, correct?
That's correct.
And that partnership develops maps for use by towns and other folks of particular wildlife habitat features and values, I believe, in the organized parts of the state.
Yes, that's correct.
And one of those maps that's provided is undeveloped habitat blocks. Isn't it true in developing those maps that the Beginning with Habitat program uses a minimum buffer of 250 feet around roads?
Yes, it does.
All right. So it's fair to say that a 50-foot impact area, indirect impact area, is fairly conservative in terms of estimating potential edge effects.
It is conservative. Beginning with Habitat right now, Connectivity Committee is actually starting to try to, has a modeling project going where they're trying to model the different roads differently in terms of impacts. So okay. 50 feet would probably be a minimum.
Okay. So it's potential that the actual indirect impact area as shown on this map is even a bit greater than the 102 acres. But even assuming that comes to I already said that. Looking at this map again, in your comments on the project application, the Natural Areas Program requested that Turbine 11 be removed because it fragments the remaining core of the northern portion of the fir, heartleaf, birch, subalpine forest into two smaller areas. And the applicant has done that. Looking at the map, doesn't the road to the southernmost four turbines and, say, turbine 14 have a similar impact in terms of breaking this community into two smaller patches?
It does.
Okay. All right. Now, your comments also expressed concern about fragmentation of this community, stating that clearing will also create unnatural edges within the natural community that will alter the habitat immediately adjacent. Expected impacts to the edge include increased light and wind, likely change the habitat by removing moisture and damaging trees. Again, looking at this map and looking at the road between, say, turbine 11 and turbine 14, and actually even farther north, this road pretty much runs the edge. It'll create a long edge along the western side of that 73 contiguous acres, that mostly that edge is exposed to the west and the southwest. Correct?
Correct.
All right. So it would be exposed essentially to the strongest sunlight of the day, the afternoon sunlight when the sun is in the southwest.
Yes.
It would also be exposed to the strongest prevailing winds, which are primarily from the west.
I'm not sure where the prevailing winds are
okay,
from.
Okay. Well, I've looked at the Rose diagrams from the Kibbe Project, and it's pretty much the west to the northwest. And also, again, since this road is on the upper part of a fairly steep west-facing slope, any screening from the other side of the road is going to be downhill, so there's not much to block the wind hitting that edge, correct?
Feasibly, yes.
Yeah. So would you say the orientation of this road creates essentially a worst-case scenario for edge effects into the interior of that community?
I don't know if I'm not going to conclude that because I don't know what the alternative road would be. It would be easier for me to do a comparison, but I can't say that this is definitely the worst case scenario of a road okay. up on the.
But the edge effects on the western side of that 73 contiguous acres are certainly worse with this than if the road was oriented, say, east-west perhaps.
But if it were oriented east-west, then it would be bisecting the community, which would create interior, you know, eliminate the interior
okay.
kind of biodiversity values we're looking for.
All right. All right. Fair enough. No further questions.
I just have a couple questions for Alan Stearns. Mr. Stearns, as Deputy Director at the Bureau of Parks and Lands, are you familiar with BPL's process for developing management plans?
Yes.
And in the past, BPL used to prepare what they called pre-planned documents before beginning to prepare an actual management plan. Is that correct?
Correct.
BPL no longer prepares pre-planned documents, do they?
Correct.
Why not?
I guess I don't want to answer that to the extent that my familiarity with the planning process isn't that intimate. Kathy Eichenberg, who's our chief of planning, did prepare an analysis based on some of the other comments in the record just about our management planning process and different staff roles and responsibilities and conclusions in that. I think I'd rather, you know, if I were to answer some of this, I'd just be reading verbatim what, from what I asked her to write. I think one of the important things, though, and this isn't where you were going, I don't want our management planning process for our land to be a primary reason to extrapolate onto private land next door. When we prepare these plans, we are not planning for it to be a regional planning document, rather a planning document for our land. So I was a, I think it's a bit unfortunate that the applicant put a bunch of stuff into the record trying to do that extrapolation. In fact, I think the extrapolation would work against the applicant because I don't think the applicant's testimony was the same as what Kathy Eichenberg has laid out. But I just okay. I'm really careful that we do these management plans all the time, and I don't want to have private landowners showing up thinking that our visual assessment of our land will be used against them as abutters. That wasn't where you were going, but
that's okay. That's good.
And I don't know, since I referenced this, I made 40, 50 copies. I don't know. I can send it electronically to Marcia in the morning, or just leave copies here if anybody wants them. This is Kathy Eichenberg's memo.
Okay, I just have one other question. Are you familiar with the High Peaks Alliance? The group that TransCanada is proposing to, they're not a non-governmental 501c3 organization, are they? They're more of an informal group of folks.
I actually just I saw the offer of tangible benefits to the High Peak Alliance. I work with them frequently, and have a lot of respect for them. Just as I was coming in today, I asked, and I understand they'll be testifying later. That they may now have corporate status and they may be looking for nonprofit status, but I think of them as a very effective advocacy group and a very effective partner as I had previously understood them as an informal coalition. It raises the issue on tangible benefits of how do you want to spend your money. I think that it is the Commission's responsibility to direct the extent and the nature of these tangible benefits. You may or may not disagree with that being within your purview. So one question is how much money, and then to whom and for what purposes. I think the High Peaks Alliance is working with the Bureau and with others on some very exciting projects, again, going back to the Plum Creek days, the issue of the credibility of the beneficiary of conservation funding was a heated discussion from this commission, and I would expect you to have concerns about giving conservation money to an entity that has not yet convinced the IRS that they are charitable. Regulatory exactions as the first deposit in a nonprofit's bank account is an interesting thing. That being said, and I'd emphasize again, the High Peaks Alliance is part of the balance of the Western Mountains that we are building, and I think that their ideas for the money are probably identical to those of many other conservation groups in the region, but if money's flying around, I think you as a commission would like to know that it's going to be well spent.
Thank you very much. I think we're done with our
good. Thank you. Friends of Boundary Mountains.
Thank you. I'd like to start off with some questions for Bob Cortes or Mr. Timpano. I'd like to go back to our friend the vernal pools for a minute, please. Could you explain to me, when a developer comes to you and says that they're going to build a development in an area that might be forested and there might be vernal pools there, and they go on a survey to find vernal pools, what is the purpose of that survey? What's the purpose of it? Can you explain that to me?
Go for it.
The purpose would be to ascertain whether or not there were actually any vernal pools, and if the survey is done at the appropriate season of the year, to determine whether or not those pools are used by breeding amphibians and how many, whether it becomes a significant vernal pool or not. Does that help?
Yes, that's very helpful. So I assume the reason they want to identify the pools is to avoid them in their construction or forestry operations. Is that correct?
If they did not do the survey and then some later point vernal pools were identified and they had not avoided them, then that would cause all kinds of problems with continuing the development.
Okay. So if you do not do the survey in the time of the year that's called for when the species are breeding, can you possibly miss vernal pools, misfinding them?
You mean just plain not discover any evidence of vernal pools at all?
That's my question. Been there? Yes.
I don't know if I can answer that directly, but you know, during that time that they're doing vernal pool surveys, they're also identifying wetlands, so those vernal pools will have wetland characteristics. It's not necessarily just the evidence of those amphibians, those breeding amphibians.
If they don't do the survey or looking for vernal pools specifically during that season of the year when it's prime to do it, is there a opportunity to miss vernal pools completely?
It would be identified as a wetland.
Was a comprehensive vernal pool survey done for this project?
Yes, we believe so.
Even though it was not done at the right time of year?
Yes.
So why does it matter if they do it in the right time of year if you're saying that they'll always identify something because it will be a wetland? I don't see why is there a protocol that says do in the spring if you could always identify them and be sure that you have them and no construction will ever interfere with them.
The survey protocol that we approve allows for surveys outside of that window and identify potential vernal pools. And that survey window is to identify significance. So they could identify in that window several vernal pools that don't meet to the level of significance.
Right.
And still would not be regulated by us.
Could they miss? But if they don't do it during the window, can they miss significant vernal pools?
I guess that's out of my expertise, and I would rely on our specialist in Bangor to answer that.
Thank you very much for your specialist in Bangor. I'd like to ask a question of Mr. Stearns, please. Are you familiar with the Friends of the Boundary Mountains before this particular project and us becoming interveners?
I've read the newspaper. That might be the extent.
Are you familiar, I assume you might be, with Mr. Ralph Knowles?
Ralph was my predecessor at the Bureau.
Were you advised by Mr. Knowles that the Friends of the Boundary Mountains had submitted a extensive conservation plan for the Boundary Mountains during his tenure in the Bureau of Parks and Lands?
Not aware. I think that gets to the issue of conservation partners. And again, I think it's exciting when conservationists deliver results and have a track record of acquisitions. So I'm not. I guess my question back to you is: has the Friends of Boundary Mountains conserved any land?
Well, we're too busy trying to save it from industrialization.
Yeah.
But I heard you say that there was no interest in conservation of the Boundary Mountains.
I certainly did not say that there's no interest in conservation.
I feel like that's what I heard you say, Mr. Stearns. Can I ask you another question? In your statements, you said that that this project presents a collision of four scenic elements of state significance, and you name those four. My question is, if there's four scenic elements of state significance in this project, why is it so hard to say that this project does not meet the level that it should meet in terms of protecting scenic resources?
I think that Mr. Palmer outlined most clearly the lack of precedent on some of the terminology that we're using. So that is one issue. I think we have essentially a new law, and certainly in my view, the most tangible application of these new scenic standards. So I think we are charting, to a certain extent, new ground. You on the commission have been through more application reviews than I have.
But, sir, are you aware that there is a project right now in front of LIRC that, despite maybe the haziness of the law, that LIRC has to make a decision on this particular application, and therefore everyone has to take a position on this application?
And I think the one thing, and I got to this earlier in terms of the back and forth, especially on the Arnold Trail, in my comments I've found it hard to distinguish the Arnold Trail from Chain of Ponds, or distinguish the Arnold Trail from the Bureau's ownership, because they are so overlapping. I think one thing I'd urge, you know, listening to Jim Palmer's comments, I'm looking at a May 6th memo from the Historic Preservation Commission, very recent. I haven't had a chance to, this is what I would want for you to have, but the Maine Historic Preservation Commission is going beyond the 1969 nomination. The Maine Historic Preservation is saying that federal guidance has evolved since the 1969 evaluation. And I think I'm trying to help you, by saying that the most recent memo from the Maine Historic Preservation Commission says that the mountains, water, landscapes, quote, are among the most important aspects of integrity the Arnold Trail possesses. There was earlier discussion of the Mr. Palmer agreeing with the hyperbole of the term vast hostile wilderness, but I'm looking at a document paid for and produced and proudly by TransCanada, where Chain of Ponds is described as stunning scenery. And if I recall the best, let me see this. The most pristine, rugged, and beautiful wilderness remaining along the expedition's march route. So Chain of Ponds is singled out by this document as the most pristine, rugged, and beautiful wilderness along the route. I think we're getting into a position of saying not significant, significant, almost yelling at each other in terms of hyperbole or not hyperbole. The simple fact is the Arnold Trail, Chain of Ponds, it's beautiful, it's wonderful, we're struggling with it, we're not all wrong, we're not all right, and it's an absolutely wonderful place in the face of Maine, and we will all struggle to come to a conclusion, and I don't claim to have the answer.
Thank you. Mr. Roque, got a few questions I'd like to ask you. In your comments, did you suggest that the blasted rock is a good method of building roads?
Yes.
And how will the leaching of this blasted rock affect downstream ecology?
That's, as far as I know from the geologists, I'm not a geologist, but if the rock has acid in it, then there are mitigation measures. The blasted rock they're using is tested to not have a an effect on the pH, so therefore it should not have an impact on the ecology.
And that's the case for all the rock that will be blasted in this project?
They are supposed to test. They don't know for sure yet, but if they find acid rock, that's not to be used in the roads for road building material, or it's going to be mitigated from what I gather. That was in my comments. I had raised a concern about how that proposal was going to be taking place, but what I would prefer to see is that the only rock used to build roads would be rock that does not affect the pH of the water.
So if they encounter rock that does affect the pH, you would not recommend using that rock. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. I want to ask you if you had suggested that the toolbox approach is a good construction method in mountain areas.
Yes.
And
can I just mention you're over your 10 minutes? So if you could.
Can I have a few more minutes?
I think it would be good if you wrap things up.
Okay. If I could ask Mr. Roque one final question. How sure are you that the toolbox construction method will not have future adverse impacts?
I guess there are very few things in this world that are absolutely positively sure of, but from what I have seen in the three projects that have been built so far, plus a number of other projects that are not high mountain, but they're in higher elevation areas, the techniques appear to work quite well, and I have not seen any of the kinds of alterations that standard construction oftentimes results in.
I see. Mr. Clement, I could ask you a question. Do I gather from your comments that the Army Corps does not differentiate between man-made or natural vernal pools?
Well, I did not make any comments relative to vernal pools, but IFNW did mention something to that effect, and so the answer to your question is yes. We do not make any distinction, or no, we don't make any distinction.
You don't make any distinction.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to... Sorry. But you got some time there that you didn't ask for up front. So, okay. What I'd like to do is take a recess. Actually, the public hearing starts at 6 o'clock, and then as soon as we finish that, we're going to go back and pick up on where we left off. Questions of commissioners to Friends of Boundary Mountains. And then cross-examination by TransCanada of Boundary Mountains and redirect by Friends of Boundary Mountains. Alan, what was the document that you, from TransCanada, what is that? We're just wondering, I think it needs to be in the record. I guess I'd be best if you don't mind giving it up.
Sure.
Thank you.